Hello neighbours, welcome to Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. I'm Ivan Imke, your host. This is episode 21 of season 2. As regular listeners know, while Fit to Eat is focused on food and agriculture in Newfoundland and Labrador, the show does travel. For example, often we've headed to Iceland, but this time we go west. Like so many of our province's population over the years, today's episode heads to Ontario, to Toronto even, only temporarily, mind you. Today we talk about urban agriculture, and what better place to discuss that than Canada's most populous city.
The urban agriculture is not recognized as a thing in a lot of official documents. When you're growing yourself, you understand a little bit about the challenges that come with growing, and I think that gives you a bit more empathy for farmers. Once the really, backyard, small-scale growers established that, yes, you can grow that crop here, then they did the research to find out, okay, can we do it at a commercial scale? And then the farmers moved on. How do we pay our farmers a living wage, but also make sure that our community members can eat? It's a tough question, but they're working on it, and that's what gives me hope.
Rhonda Teitelpain is a co-coordinator of the Toronto Urban Growers. She's regularly asked by media for her expertise on whatever is happening at the moment in food production in that city, whether it be related to markets or access to land or that favorite urban topic, chickens. But her observations are relevant well beyond that region. I expect that you'll find they resonate with you in whatever community you are, from St. John's to St. Fintan's to St. Anthony to St. Louis. I met up with her just as the pandemic was bearing down on us. Originally, our chat was for a series I was planning on urban agriculture. That hasn't happened yet. But Rhonda's experience is too good to let lay silent on a digital recorder any longer. I dropped by her house, the one with the farm in front.
My name is Rhonda Teitelpain, and I'm a co-coordinator at Toronto Urban Growers, and I am somewhat of an urban grower myself. So here at my house in the front yard and backyard, I have things like pollinator plants and trees, but then we also grow a lot of food. And when people ask me what I grow, it's kind of like a conversation, I think, between the space and myself. So for instance, there are a bunch of things that come up on their own, such as like the amaranths and the tomatillos that I planted originally, but plant themselves with abandon. And then there are things that I want to grow every year, which is like an ever-changing roster. So it's back and forth between letting some of this stuff grow that comes up just on its own and creating a bit of space for what I want to grow. Yeah.
I knew I was at the right house because I saw from the street that you had lots of plants growing.
So. It's easy to give directions.
The house with the farm in front of it.
Yeah. Although that's yeah. Changing now because it used to be every front yard was lawn, and now more and more of my neighbors are starting to plant food and pollinator plants as well. So,
did you grow up in a family where you grew things?
My grandfather and uncle had a huge vegetable patch. They lived in a house across from Lake Simcoe. Mm-hmm. And so they had a double lot. So one lot was the house. The other part of the lot was a big vegetable garden.
So what values do you find in growing things other than the food itself? What does it do for you?
Like immediately, personally for me, I love having a connection to my neighbors. So mm-hmm. when I'm working out in the front yard, all kinds of people will stop by and talk and ask questions and so on. And that's something you don't always get in a big city. So that's amazing. As well as the neighbors who are also really keen on starting to grow stuff. And we exchange seeds and plants and tips and ideas and so on. So it's that social piece to it. But, on a deeper level, it's a very spiritual thing for me. And I didn't understand this until I actually started growing. But you really are deeply involved in the process of creating life. And it's not like a Dr. Frankenstein kind of thing, like, I will create life. It's about being in a relationship with the space that you're in and all of the organisms that are in there. And it's like a conversation back and forth. It's not a, I'm going to impose my will on this garden space. What are we going to do together?
Is it possible that living in a city that there's a special need for this kind of a relationship to nature?
Yeah, it's a combination of a relationship to nature, but also a relationship to food. Because a lot of people are really feeling an emptiness when it comes to going to a grocery store and seeing vegetables packed up in styrofoam, and the disconnect from where the food comes from, both the way that it's grown, but also the people who are doing the growing. We just are so disconnected from that, and I think people are really looking to replace that. But you also said nature, and I think that's important too, because people don't necessarily equate growing food with nature. Mm-hmm. It is a very different kind of nature than what you will find in a ravine, or if you go up to Algonquin Park or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, it's not that kind of nature. But it is very much about, you know, when you're growing food, there is life in the soil and there are pollinators and the birds and those, even the squirrels and the raccoons that we all grumble about. I mean, that's all a whole ecosystem. And I think people do like that connection. And it's different every year. There is no end of learning. Even if you're in the same space year after year, different things happen every year. And being connected to those cycles, I think, fills a gap for a lot of people.
When you talk to people, what is it that they want from their food? And what's the effect of that disconnection with food as well?
Well, this is what I really love to talk to people about, not just so much about how do you grow, but why. And a lot of times it's people have a connection to their family. So this is a family tradition. A lot of times it's a cultural connection. So the place that either they were born or their parents or relatives further back used to grow these kinds of foods and you can't get them here or what you get here is not very fresh. So it's a way to connect back to a cultural practice. Yeah. But it's also a way of just sort of getting control over the food system, which is maybe academic speak, but it's knowing where your food came from, knowing it's food that matters to you for a bunch of reasons, and knowing that you grew it yourself, and so you can trust it.
Do you think people who have their own gardens are much slower shopping as well because they're looking at the labels? Does it make them more conscious about everything?
Yeah. I think so. And I think the other thing is that it makes you think more about the people who are growing the food. So when you're growing yourself, you understand a little bit about the challenges that come with growing. And I think that gives you a bit more empathy for farmers. Mm-hmm. And you realize that this isn't some anonymous machine industrial system that's producing my food. It's it's people who are also impacted on a much bigger scale.
Mm-hmm. The relationship between people in the city who practice urban agriculture and people out in the country who practice what might be considered more conventional agriculture is not always a smooth relationship because they don't necessarily know each other. How do we get around that? How do we create bridges?
Well, finding common ground, because I think farmers in rural areas are not a uniform mass. Everybody has different practices.
Yes.
So my thought is that urban growers will probably connect to farmers who use more kind of organic practices and do more agroecology. I think there's a lot more opportunity to connect across those grounds because that's how city growers tend to grow as well. So they understand that a bit more. Mm-hmm. If you're going to a farmer's market and all you're doing is getting garlic, you're still meeting that farmer and you're still having that opportunity to have a conversation. Regardless of what kind of agriculture you practice, there is kind of one way of thinking that I've heard that I'm realizing now is called transactional gardening. So the idea is that you are giving something to the garden. I'm putting compost in and I'm going to take produce out. And that's how I think a lot of growers think. It is just putting in, taking out. The kind of growing, like when I'm talking to you about this conversation with the garden, to me that's relational growing. And it's about not seeing the garden or the ground as a resource or as a thing that you use, but you're understanding it as something that you have a relationship with. And so it's about more than just, you know, I'm going to put in and take it out. It's, I need to respect this space and I need to respect the creatures that are in it. And almost like you're asking permission. The first time I thought of that, I thought, wait a minute. It's not like I say, hey, can I do this? But really, it is, because when you're adding amendments and so on, you are basically saying, here, I'm offering this and I would like this to come back. And it's not a given, because anything can happen.
Yeah.
You could have a pest invasion, you could have bad weather. So it's always going back and forth.
Yeah.
And I think if more gardeners think of it in that relational way as opposed to transactional, I think for one thing, they're going to treat gardens a lot better. And for another thing, we're going to be a little less heartbroken when things don't go. Because, you know, there are always things that go wrong in a garden. And if your expectation is, I put all of this into it, why is this not working out? Then you're going to have a hard time. It's going to be difficult. I've seen gardeners who just get so depressed.
Yeah.
So, but if you think of it as a relational thing, sometimes relationships go wrong. It doesn't mean that you stop the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It just means you figure out, okay, what's going wrong here? And the garden will tell you things and you will tell the garden things. So that sounds maybe a little new agey, but
well, I think
it's just an interesting way of looking at the garden. And I credit hearing indigenous indigenous people talking about their relationship to the land for getting me thinking this way.
But that's recognizing the power of nature and the gift of nature in all of this, and the fact that we aren't really in control.
And that's okay. And that's that the story doesn't have to be about I'm dominating, I'm exerting my will on.
I extracted 14 damages from this square foot.
It's an extraction industry.
Do you have a piece of music that I can use for part of this?
There are two songs, a band called Tribe Called Red, and two of their songs are collaborations with Latin American musicians. Mm-hmm. And I just love that because, well, first of all, if you're a grower, rebuilding that relationship with indigenous communities is really phenomenally important. Yeah. But then also, you know, the collaboration between indigenous musicians and Latino musicians kind of gets that all of these different cultural groups can form partnerships and work together, and, you know, white people don't need to be in the middle of it. These groups can also find common ground. So the one is off their latest album. It's called Tano Cumbia.
That was the indigenous electronic duo, A Tribe Called Red. Earlier this year, they changed their name to the Halusa Nation. On this track, they were joined by El Dusty and Black Bear. The track was requested by our guest today, Rhonda Title Payne, who helps to promote urban agriculture in Toronto. In this second section, I start by asking Rhonda about the origins of the Toronto urban growers.
So there have been kind of networks for people who are growing food in the city for a long time, but they tended to focus on like community gardens. So in around 2008, people gathered who were coming from organizations, who were farmers, who were city staff, who said, you know what, the growing food in the city movement is moving beyond just community gardeners. So what does the landscape look like right now around that? And they flagged a whole bunch of issues to say, you know what, we have trouble getting access to land. There are policies that are getting in the way. We want to learn from each other. What's the best way to do that? And so they said, you know, a network, bringing all of these different people together is the way to go. And what has happened is that it has been a brilliant gathering of so many different kinds of growers, from backyard growers to community gardeners to people who are starting businesses to institutions, who are all finding ways to grow food in the city and all the other things that come out of that.
And so this provides an opportunity for people to know about what's going on in the region?
That's one really big function, is whether it be sort of through in-person meetings or online activity, people just want to see who else is doing what, to get inspiration, to get ideas, to say, hey, we're both facing the same issues. How do we work on this together?
How are we doing, you know, in Toronto in terms of urban agriculture?
There are some places where Toronto has made a lot of progress, and other places where we're so far behind in terms of having enough infrastructure and in terms of having policies in place. So it's kind of one step forward, two steps back, three steps sideways.
So when you talk about infrastructure, are you referring to access to land?
Access to land is the biggest one.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's social infrastructure in terms of learning and so on, but I think that one is easier to figure out. But definitely access to land and having policies that support that access to land, and then the support the use of the land is the other piece. And to be fair, you know, it's part of the reason why it's challenging around policy is because urban ag is changing all the time and people are coming up with new and innovative ways to grow. So it's hard for policymakers to keep up. But at the same time, time, there are some basic things. The urban agriculture is not recognized as a thing in a lot of official documents, and people are just trying to get food in there, let alone the specific act of urban agriculture. So I think once we're able to get that kind of recognition in, then a lot of other things will fall into place.
Is it possible that sometimes if things are not quantified, that we don't have numbers, people don't take it seriously?
It is
very hard to quantify the food that's grown in a city like Toronto, I could imagine.
It's hard to quantify the amount of food that's grown. Yes, for sure, wherever you are. There are other places that have quantified the impacts of urban agriculture.
Okay.
But
what
we hear when we connect with decision makers is, well, you don't have enough local data. So, and to some degree, that's fair. So part of our struggle is to try and get that local data, is try to measure what's happening here in Toronto. You know, the quantity of food is only one measure, and there are a bunch of other measures that, that talk about why are we growing food in Toronto. Well, we're creating habitat for pollinators. We're helping stormwater management. So every time it rains, does all the water go crashing into the sewer system and overwhelm it? Or does it get filtered through a bunch of green spaces? Food can contribute to that. Is the temperature, like ground level temperature, is that increasing, decreasing? You know, there was someone at the University of Toronto who, they have a rooftop garden. They measured the temperature on one rooftop versus the other. So one rooftop, no garden. The other one did have a garden, modest garden. 20 degrees difference, he said.
Really?
So that's pretty significant.
It is, and that's local data.
Yeah.
Some people are growing food out of income insecurity. That would be an effect that would be hard to actually measure, probably, but it's very true.
Yeah. You know, that's one of my, personal struggles that I really, I'm really trying to get the message across, because a lot of people think in terms of economic benefits as being how many full-time jobs are created. Well, the food industry is a big employer, but urban agriculture is not. But we're looking at ways to do what we call community economic development. And what that means is getting growers to generate an income. It may not be a full-time salary, but it's extra income. And for people who are living on a low income, even a small amount of money makes a huge difference in terms of their quality of life. So if you look at it from that perspective, then yes, the economic impact is measurable. And if you can tell that story, it's, is significant.
It is interesting that 45% of Canadian farmers work off the farm in some capacity. So to expect that urban agriculturalists would also be full-time, you know, work is sort of unrealistic. It's not the way food is grown.
Well, there are people who are doing it, but it's few and far between. But there are other benefits that, that can come. And there are lots of studies about how much income people save by growing their own food. What's one I heard that's something like $8 per square foot in a community garden? So you're offsetting like household costs there.
I haven't been exposed to a lot of organizations, but I've been really struck by the fact that the ones that I've met with and talked to are doing more than just food, that they're really involved in other activities, whether it be literacy or anti-poverty or mental health. Or it seems like the urban agriculture has grasped the value of growing for other therapeutic uses or whatever. Is it fair to say that? That there's more than just what an agenda when you've got a community garden. There's a lot of agendas that are being pushed forward.
I don't know how much that has to do with the fact that when you're in an urban setting and space is really at a premium, that you need to do more than one thing, or if it's just the kinds of people who are doing the growing are automatically not just farmers. They're doing other things. But it's also just, you can. If you are growing food, there are a lot of other things that make sense to do. In fact, growing food is a way to bring people in to these other kinds of work. So if what you want to do is you want to build a strong community, you're living in a place where nobody talks to each other, everyone comes from very different backgrounds. If you're starting a community garden and you do it well, then people come to the garden because they like the green space, because they see the food, because they can get involved, because it's a place where they can talk about their own food traditions and knowledge and so on, or contribute that knowledge. And that is when people start coming together on common ground and talking to each other a little bit more. When the stereotypes get broken down, both because they're working directly with people who are very different, but they also see, well, you know what? What I heard about these people being whatever stereotype you want to apply, well, actually, they have something to give back to the community as well.
I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but are you saying if Queen's Park or Ottawa were to become a garden, all that lawn space and all of the members of Parliament would go out and garden?
that would maybe make it better governing?
And get to know each other.
Well, you see, that's the problem with over-promising. Yeah. Urban agriculture is not going to do
everything. Oh, it's not going to do
everything.
That. Okay.
It's not going to do everything. It's a great dream, but I think that it takes a little bit more.
A Tribe Called Red, along with El Dusty and Black Bear, with a song called Tano Cumbia. Today on Fit to Eat, I'm talking with Rhonda Title Payne of the Toronto Urban Growers about the challenges and joys of growing and raising food in the city.
In some parts of the country, one of the big things that causes division among city councils and so on are chickens.
Yes.
It seems to me like you've got a map with chicken-free towns. And has that been an issue in Toronto?
Yeah. We're in the middle of a three-year pilot project. Oh. And the debates at the beginning, when they first instituted the pilot project, were incredible, both in terms of people articulating really well why chickens should be allowed, but also just the misconceptions around having chickens. And to me, it really highlighted our sense of the food system as, food doesn't belong in the city. It belongs somewhere out there. So we're in the middle of this pilot project. Yeah. And so far, it sounds like it's going really well. Okay. And people are trying out growing chickens. Yeah. And they're understanding that it's not as easy as it sounds, but it's also not as complicated. I'm hoping that means we're going to have chickens across the city. One of the reasons why I want to see the chicken pilot transcend from a pilot project to just being generally accepted is having chickens allowed in the city is just one step. For me, the next thing is, how do we move the chickens from beyond the backyard chicken? Yeah. So someone who's already a homeowner or a renter or whatever who has access to that space, what about people living in apartment buildings? There are some interesting models, both here in Toronto and around the world, of shared chicken owning. So, for instance, in Australia, I think it is, in public housing, there, families can have chickens for 2 weeks. And so the chickens get rotated around different housing projects. Yeah. So you get the eggs for 2 weeks and you look after the chickens and then it moves on. Yeah. And it means you don't have to be committed to having them all the time. Yeah. Or a place in a community garden where, aside from the garden plots, you've got a collectively managed chicken coop. Why not?
Do you ever see goats? Or sheep?
I have not seen goats. In Montreal, they do have a program called La Biquette, and they have a herd of sheep that they move around from one public park to another.
Okay,
and they graze.
They graze and leave behind gifts.
Yeah. And then they set up a little fenced in area and families can come and see the sheep and so on. I think it's brilliant. Well, when I was a kid, I lived not too far from these big oil tanks, and they had goats all the time to graze the grass because they didn't want to have lawnmowers with sparks and stuff like that. Around big oil tanks? No.
Is there a crop that you would like to see grown more here in the city, or that you personally would like to grow, that you think there's a real potential?
There's a ton of potential. We did a project called the World Crops Project.
Yeah.
And there are a bunch of growers who are trying to figure out how to grow crops from around the world and connect to markets here. So whether it be restaurants or small grocery stores. And, there were a number of crops that were identified that are not commercially available because, for whatever reasons, commercial growers haven't taken them up. But the smaller scale urban growers are ready to do that and are completely suited to do that kind of growing. I'd like to see more energy invested into figuring out what those things are, because I think a lot of the vegetables that we see now grown by commercial growers that didn't originate from here, I think originally they were grown by community gardeners and by backyard growers, because how else would anyone know that those those crops would thrive here. And so once the really, you know, backyard small-scale growers established that, yes, you can grow that crop here, then they did the research to find out, okay, can we do it at a commercial scale? And then the farmers moved on.
That would be another evidence-gathering process, because it's really sort of citizen science. People are growing whatever they can or trying to grow, but I don't know if there's a formal way in which we can acknowledge what's possible.
Well, there is a place, the Vineland Research and Innovation Center.
Yeah.
They do that, but they're doing it for commercial scale.
But they don't necessarily come to the backyards of Toronto and say, what are you able to grow here? And maybe we can too. What's some of your favorite local food?
I'm really crazy about amaranth. It grows ridiculously tall, has an abundance of green leaves that you can use like spinach. And one of these days I'm going to start a blog all about 101 ways to cook amaranth.
That's the amaranth lady there. That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
It comes up all on its own, whether you want it to or not.
See, most of us, when we think of amaranth, if we know it at all, we know it as this little
grain
that you buy in the store or you get in a fancy restaurant or whatever.
Yeah. People actually ask me if I harvest the grain, and for me, it's too much fuss to...
Okay.
I'd rather leave it for the birds, but the leaves are great.
Are.
One of the quirky things I grow is Peruvian morado corn, which grows to about 12, 13, 14 feet high, and it's a beautiful purple stalk and then gets these crazy roots. So it's a very attractive plant, but it produces these purple corn cobs that you can't eat as sweet corn, but you boil it with pineapple and apples and spices, and it makes a drink called chicha morada, which is supposed to be very healthy, the dark purple color.
Yeah.
And then the corn husks you use for making tamales. And we've been discovering that this corn also grows a fungus known in Mexico as huitlacoche, or corn smut, which is really high in nutrition and looks terrible. You look at it, you think, there's no way on the planet I want to eat this stuff. But when you cook it, it's delicious.
If you're thinking about urban agriculture, is there something that makes you particularly optimistic?
Yeah, the people who are doing the growing, because some of them are just so knowledgeable and a really deep knowledge, not just about, okay, I can make this plant happen, but how to work with the natural world to make it happen. But also the reasons why they're doing it. People are very committed to saying, you know, there are people in my community who can't eat, and that's not right, and I'm going to do what I can. So a lot of the organizations who are trying to figure out this question of, okay, how do we pay our farmers a living wage, but also make sure that our community members can eat? It's a tough question, but they're working on it, and that's what gives me hope.
It seems like so many problems around us in the world are so huge that we don't know how we even start to address them.
Oh, yeah. Well, and you know, this is one of my favorite pitches about gardening now is the stepping stone theory. You know, if you see a big abyss in front of you, like climate change, like racism, like poverty, you're not going to jump off that cliff and move forward.
Right.
You need something to jump to. If you're looking at like climate change, for instance, if you get people into the garden growing and you talk to them about how this little tiny garden is actually contributing to reducing the impacts and reducing the effects, then they're going to say, oh, okay, I can do this. I can contribute to a larger effort. And then that opens up the door to thinking about more things, like what else they can do.
Thanks so much, Rhonda, for taking
the
time.
Well, it's been great talking.
If you want more information about the Toronto Urban Growers, you can check out their website at torontourbangrowers.org. And if you're interested in the topics around urban agriculture in Toronto, check out the Facebook site Grow Food Toronto. And if you live in a community and you're struggling to increase the amount of food grown there, know that you're working on the side of the angels. And as for the Toronto chicken pilot, it has been extended to the end of March 2022. After that, a final decision will be made. Stay tuned.
It's a very spiritual thing for me, and I didn't understand this until I actually started growing. But you really are deeply involved in the process of creating life. There's no end of learning, even if you're in the same space year after year. Different things happen every year. People just want to see who else is doing what, to get inspiration, to get ideas, to say, hey, we're both facing the same issues. If you're going to a farmer's market and all you're doing is getting garlic, you're still meeting that farmer and you're still having that opportunity to have a conversation. If you see a big abyss in front of you, like climate change, like racism, like poverty, you're not going to jump off that cliff and move forward. You need something to jump to.
This has been Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. To listen to other episodes of the show or for more information, go to fittoeatnl.ca. The song for today's show was Tana Cumbia by a band once called A Tribe Called Red. It's now called Hallucination. They were playing along with El Dusty and Black Bear. The theme music, Cluck Old Hen, was performed this week by a young rising band out of the southern U.S. called, oddly enough, Rising Appalachia. This is a production of Kitchen Table Communications. I'm Ivan Emke. Join me again next time. I'll be right here. Happy trails.
I'm really crazy about amaranth.